TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Where are the people in the nuclear age? Norma Field. In the annals of nuclear accidents, Fukushima has a special place. In Chernobyl, the government opted to remove the 116,000 people living around the power plant. In Fukushima, there's an ongoing effort to remove the contamination and to bring the 154,000 evacuees back. The Japanese government claims the effort is successful. Independent researchers have serious doubts. As of the end of 2017, there are 30 million bags of radioactive waste collected from houses and roads throughout Fukushima Prefecture. Each bag weighs 1 ton, and while waiting to be processed, the plastic tears and strange trees are growing out of the bags. Admittedly, the cleanup so far only reached 5% of Fukushima province, and the only peer-reviewed data on the status come from independent researchers. They find that contamination returned to cleanup areas via wind, rain, and traffic. That includes radioactive particles of uranium, thorium, radium, cesium, strontium, polonium, tellurium, and americium. Norma Field is an author and professor emeritus of East Asian Studies at the University of Chicago. She has taught pre-modern Japanese poetry and prose and gender studies. She's a frequent visitor to Japan, where she was born in 1947. Norma Field and Arne Gundersen spoke in Chicago at the beginning of December 2017 to express their concern about the unquestioned celebration of the first nuclear chain reaction. It was set in motion in Chicago Pile 1 by Enrico Fermi at the University of Chicago 75 years earlier. The nuclear industry and nuclear weapons interests had rushed to Chicago in 2017 to report on their plans for future weapons production and more nuclear power stations. Norma Field spoke for NEIS on December 2nd, 2017. The Nuclear Energy Information Service had invited her and Arne Gundersen to call attention to the plight of people who suffer the consequences of radiation. Norma Field.
I've been thinking again about nuclear weapons rather more than I'm accustomed to lately. I've been thinking much more about nuclear reactors, but it's been very salutary in reminding me that these technologies cannot be separated, and they're played off against each other to justify each. What are nuclear weapons? What's their justification? Obviously, to protect a country against an external enemy. What about nuclear power? It's supposed to bring prosperity to local and regional communities, right? That's what justifies these two. And then thirdly, which is something I won't talk about very much, medicine, diagnosis, and therapy. There was a wonderful moment yesterday when the moderator asked very innocently of the two doctor researchers who were on the nuclear medicine panel, is nuclear medicine related to weapons and defense? And the response that came out was, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that. I will say just, you know, I would not hesitate to get radiation therapy or use diagnostic or whatever tools for myself or people I care about or any human being who needs it at the moment. At the same time, the bland defense of it, like I can imagine medicine finally becoming what justifies both the above two. If the first two become too risky in the social psyche. Okay, so science, it's summoned all the time in Japan, but it happened in Chernobyl, and it happened in the American Southwest too and elsewhere. Science is used to claim that health effects are mostly in your head, right? And it's called radiophobia. Some people call it nuclear phobia. That worrying about radiation is worse for you than the actual effects can be. Now, that should never, ever be substituted for the actual injuries that they have been and continue to suffer. But when science is summoned like that, it is horrendous. I'll quote Timothy Mousseau, great evolutionary biologist who's worked on the barn swallow in Chernobyl and also has been working in Fukushima too. One thing he will say is that the barn swallow does not suffer from radiophobia. So if changes appear in the barn swallow's body, it must be real in some way, and rather than psychic. Well, maybe if we could get therapists for barn swallows, we would find out that Tim is wrong, but in any case. And the other worst thing, I think, science goes one step further in Fukushima, and I'll get back to this later, I hope, is that one of the lasting legacies of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs is discrimination against the victims. So the victims are at least twice victimized. They've had the bombs inflicted on them, and then they have to worry about their children and grandchildren suffering from discrimination in marriage and employment. And this immediately became a hot topic in Fukushima after the disaster. We hear about cars with Fukushima plates being trashed, parents trying to get their children to boarding schools outside at a very early age. This is not a common practice in Japan because they want their children to break any bureaucratic record of their children's ties to Fukushima canceled early on so that they won't suffer. So one of the things science has begun to say is if you continue to be unscientific and keep expressing your worries about health and about the safety of our food products, you're just inviting discrimination against Fukushima, right? Think about your fellow Fukushima citizens and stop talking about worries. You can imagine what kind of pressure this creates on people living in Fukushima who might be worried too. This is slightly different, but the whole issue of progress, right? It struck me listening to a group of esteemed ethicists at the University of Chicago Divinity School, you know, posing this question ponderously. Do you ever want to stop science's search for truth? This is very commonplace. It's not just ethicists at the University of Chicago Div School who pose that question. There's something we consider sacred about the scientist's mission. We don't remember that the scientific truths that get found out are usually, now more than ever, scientific truths that have been funded, that have had funding to get there, and that there are many truths that scientists are not able to uncover because they don't have the funding to do it. That's another issue with Fukushima too. So there's that, but there's that kind of sanctity of the scientific mission. I kept hearing that in the background over the University of Chicago commemoration, that this was great science. This is what science was able to discover. And then on a technological level, right, we can produce smaller, more portable nuclear weapons. We can produce small modular reactors, small, portable, safer, so forth and so on. And I think that technological discourse relies tacitly on the sanctity given to scientific knowledge and exploration. And I find it really annoying and dangerous. I should say that part of the motivation for me in doing this work comes from a friend and colleague I had at the University of Chicago, no longer with us. She was a Hanford downwinder who died of a cancer in her mid-40s. But anyway, a useful map, although no map is complete. It shows areas of the United States crossed by two or more clouds during atmospheric tests in Nevada, 51 to 62. And we should learn to read this map envisioning Nevada test site workers, atomic veterans, downwinders, as we know, who would include many, many Native Americans. We have to note that up in the Northwest, Hanford in Washington State, maybe the worst clean-up site, not clean-upable site in the United States, which manufactured the plutonium for the Nagasaki bomb. You can't tell the harm that was taking place there, nor can you tell the harm taking place in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific. I just read, some of you that may have read the news report this week of Eniwetok Atoll, which was one of the places terribly contaminated, And now they're getting a double whammy after having been returned there, having the atoll declared safe for return. Now the rising sea waters will probably make their home disappear, and it has tons and tons of waste irresponsibly dumped there by the United States. And also, I have to say, these are all testing sites, human radiation testing sites for the United States. And one of the things said about the Marshall Islanders early on, it's a secret project 4.1, was a government official saying of Marshall Islanders, they're not civilized like white people, but, quote, they are more like us than mice. Marshall Islanders are more like us than mice, so it's still worthwhile testing them, because that result will get us closer to what's happening to truly civilized white people. All right, now I want to get right straight to the University of Chicago here. Ed Markey, right, name many of you will recognize, currently senator from Massachusetts. This is a report that came out in 1986 to the House Subcommittee that then Congressperson Markey chaired. I think the title captures it. I mean, we're so unused to hearing honest words spoken out of our Congress that this title, American Nuclear Guinea Pigs, Three Decades of Radiation Experiments on U.S. Citizens, is fantastic. That's exactly what it is. It covers about 31 tests, including 699, about 700 people. What is important about this? The University of Chicago comes up about 6 or 7 times in this, along with other institutions like UC Berkeley, UC San Francisco, MIT, labs like Los Alamos and Oak Ridge. Oh, they're doing things like injecting plutonium into terminally ill patients, except that some of them turn out not to be so terminal. They live on for 20 years. I don't know what happened to them, but I can't help thinking that people who were already ill, who don't die from getting plutonium injected into them, but continue to live 20 years, might not have exactly had a robust 20 years to live on. And we don't learn these things from these reports. But a report that particularly caught my eyes, not because it's worse than anything else that we see there, like Marshall Islanders, that doesn't show up at all, is one involving University of Chicago students and staff. 1961 to 63, 102 students and staff were fed actual pieces of Nevada test site fallout or simulated pieces of test site fallout. They were getting worried about all those above ground tests and where's that fallout going since we have a lot of people there. And you need to find out how these radioactive substances pass through the body. So have them ingest it, eat it, in some cases solution, so drink it, and then see what comes out of the body. They also know that not all of it comes out, and they also knew then that internalizing radioactivity is actually more harmful than merely external exposure. I was shocked yesterday at the University of Chicago panel to hear one of the doctor scientists saying, the old thing, you've heard it, flying from X to Y is more harmful to you than any radiation you might be exposed to on the ground. Just kept giving these examples of external exposure as if that were the sum of it. Shouldn't scientists be embarrassed to pass off such information, as facts? Okay, many of you may have seen pictures of American soldiers, atomic veterans, they're called out to witness nuclear explosions. Again, interest in seeing what this stuff does to the human body. Soldiers are very convenient. It's only in the Gulf War that I learned that when you join the Army, you give up a lot of your human rights. You're tested with injections that the FDA hasn't approved yet, et cetera, et cetera. Well, these soldiers' well-being obviously was not being looked after. How many soldiers were exposed in this way? I'm particularly pleased to have found this because this is soldiers watching the explosion of Small Boy. And as you'll see in the text on the right, the actual fallout that was fed University of Chicago students and staff was from Small Boy. I would love to get the survivors in the left hand and the survivors in the right hand together. I don't know, is there a hashtag that would make them recognize themselves? If you think of one, let me know, because they deserve to know. and they deserve to meet each other. They really do, and this should be part of any institution, not just the University of Chicago, reflecting back on this era. Okay, this is a contrast that's often drawn by Japanese activists, that whereas in the former Soviet Union, human beings were moved away from the most contaminated place, in Japan, you keep them on site, and you do what is called decontamination. And most of us now say this is manipulation, deceptive manipulation. All they're doing is moving pollution. Because what are you going to do about this mountainous prefecture, precipitation, etc.? But some of you will immediately think, but the former Soviet Union was huge, right? They had all, and also it was a socialist economy, granted. But one of the things that's been a big topic in Japan for decades now is rural depopulation. There are these limit communities where young people don't exist. It's very hard. There are a lot of rural areas that Fukushima farmers could have been assisted to move to, for instance. And in any case, what's going on is extraordinary criminal. It's just criminal. I love Arnie's picture of the decontamination bags because it had a tree growing out of it. Let me contextualize this in a different way. It's really hard if you don't go to places that had the earthquake and the tsunami. It's hard to show the damage done to Fukushima by the nuclear disaster. Why? Because radiation's invisible, right? If you're not showing the plant, you're not showing things like the bags. In fact, I had a friend who asked me last year, she said, Norm, I have a bunch of people coming to Fukushima City, and I'm supposed to give them a tour, and I don't know what to show them. And I said, right, you've got to tell them that the minute they get to the station. Tell them, it's really hard for me to show you the harm. There's a place in Fukushima City up a hill, so concealed, right? Fukushima City, let's remember, is the prefectural seat of government. It's where the bullet train stops. No way the government was going to evacuate Fukushima City, although it has numerous hot spots. And then there are Olympic fields, too. They're bags, but they're on a hilltop, so they can't be seen from below. There are these monitoring posts. The monitoring posts, which are rigged anyway, you know, they might have lit around the bases or... Well, there was one company that produced a first set of monitoring posts to show the airborne radiation, and it seemed to measure too accurately, so the prefecture commissioned another company. So in many places, oddly enough, you will see two posts side by side, one of which isn't the needle's not moving. Anyway, but even that's kind of iffy. So the point now that there's an effort to remove them, and sometimes the citizens who still have the energy will protest the removal of a monitoring post from their community. But this is one place where we can see the harm. Volume reduction facility. There are a bunch of these that have been built at huge cost. Huge cost. These are temporary facilities. You can imagine that having all those bags around is not good in the recovery campaign, right? And so you have to do something about them. And this is one of the solutions, a volume reduction facility. Arnie can tell us more about how helpful these things are. First of all, by reducing the volume or concentrating the radioactivity. And these things are releasing all the time necessarily as part of their operation. And think of what is under the facility in the ground once it's shut up. Oddly enough, I've seen two of these facilities right near the community graveyards, the cemeteries. And they want to warn people who are coming to the graves of their family members not to light incense because the air is so dry and might set off a fire. So, and guess what? Your thoughts sincerely sent out will reach your dead loved ones. So don't feel like you have to literally light an incense. And this one, sweetly enough, is from the Village Women Firefighters Association. So that kind of, bureaucratic tragicomedy. There's evidence of that everywhere. The schools are intent on giving children the proper knowledge about radioactivity, right? For very young children, I went to one of the huge, you know, multi-million, if not billion-dollar complexes with some facilities are for some parts of the facility for research, others for community events. There's a place where you can leave your kids. There are tatami mat rooms, really cozy, kind of sterile, but kind of cozy. Nice space. And then they had a huge screen, and the screen is teaching very young children, preschool children, about alpha particles, beta particles, and gamma rays. And everybody knows papers, rocks, scissors, right? The children are taught to, as the alpha particle shows up, if you can put out your two fingers, you can conquer that alpha particle with scissors. And beta might be rock. And gamma rays, paper. Anyway, and then there's a sweet young woman there, and there you have the kids. I got one picture with kids and a mother and the woman to encourage them. And they're kind of all bopping around the screen. And say, moms, you're not doing as good, well as your kids. Come on, let's get in the action. Right, early on, show your children that radioactivity is not to be feared. All right. Thyroid cancer, pediatric thyroid cancer. You may have heard that there are extraordinary levels of youth and pediatric thyroid cancer in Japan. And there are, because up to now, it's been considered a very rare form of cancer for children, for this population. Thyroid cancer is on the rise around the world, I have read. But right now, what is it, 193 cases confirmed or suspected. By suspected only means that the children have not had surgery yet, and therefore, without analyzing the organs, they can't say definitively. Probably that is not the complete picture. However, some of you might even remember the heralded Professor Jerry Thomas, one of the scientists in favor of nuclear, saying right after the Fukushima disaster, thyroid cancer is one of the best cancers you can get. And say that to people having a hard time with their hormones after thyroid removal. But anyway, because you catch it and it's out and no problems. However, one thing that Fukushima is teaching people, and I don't see enough written on this in English, that thyroid cancer in children and youth seems to move much faster than in adults. And so while the authorities or medical authorities are busily touting the screening effect that, oh, you know, the Soviets, they didn't have the accurate instruments. We have too many accurate instruments being an advanced country, and that's why we're diagnosing cancers that should just be watched, if anything, that are never going to cause trouble to these kids. In fact, the Prefectural Medical Association, Pediatric Association last year was proposing that coming up with so many cases of child and youth cancers is causing what? Guess what? Anxiety, stress among the people of Fukushima. It is not beneficial to the people of Fukushima. Therefore, we should start scaling down the screening, right? But the people involved in this, the brave people, one of the scientists who was involved in the parliamentary committee to study the nuclear is a champion of this for these children and their families, are saying, no, this is not the screening effect, because we have found among the children and youth who've had surgery, distant metastasis, for example, recurrence. No, we need to be doing this more widely, because the plume didn't stop, the iodine didn't stop, the radioactive iodine did not stop at prefectural borders. But only in Fukushima can you get the screening examination for it. We should be examining it and more fully, and we should be paying attention. We need to catch these cases early. All right, my theme right now is about the difficulty of making radiation harm visible. So 2016, I thought this was amazing. This was dubbed as the coming out of thyroid cancer families of children. So by children and youth, I mean that the survey began with those who were 18 and under and living in Fukushima at the time. So it was a coming out of these families. Again, remember, we're worried about discrimination. And so that's one of the big snags, and what will surely become more and more urgent is to guarantee free health care for people who experience this, as happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Again, the great worry about being known as having a cancer in your family has kept everyone anonymous and isolated and stressed out. You know, it's another source of stress in families. I read a really painful one of an interview, no names, where a middle school-aged son had had to have surgery. And whom did he blame? His mother. Said, "You made me with this defective body." Oh. Right? This is a kind of a structure that will make the most vulnerable turn against each other. So they will be too preoccupied speaking truth to power. Anyway, so I was really looking forward to this press conference, and this is what happened. These are the reporters in a room in Tokyo, and two fathers appeared, and they were speaking from Fukushima, and this was their coming out. Showed only the trunks of their bodies. Their voices were altered so they couldn't be identified. In other words, it's as if they who might make visible evidence of Fukushima health harm had to be made invisible in a way, right? You see, it just keeps on turning on itself and not working to help the people who need the help. And moreover, hiding their faces as if they were criminals, as if they are injuring society, and in a certain logic in Fukushima. Don't talk about harm in Fukushima. We're getting the Olympics. The Olympics signals our recovery. It's carrot and stick. I don't know how it actually works as a carrot, but certainly a huge stick. Don't you dare say or do anything that suggests it's not safe to be living here. So this is what I come back to. Who is protected by nuclear weapons? Who's the enemy? And who's made prosperous by nuclear power? Okay, thank you.
That was Norma Field, advocating for people in the nuclear age. She's an author and professor emeritus of East Asian Studies at the University of Chicago. She spoke for NEIS on December 2nd, 2017. The Nuclear Energy Information Service invited her to Chicago to counterbalance the celebration of the first nuclear chain reaction that made nuclear weapons and nuclear power possible. And thanks to Dale Lehman from WZRD for this recording. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.